Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome. My name is John Woolley. I'm the professor of political science and the chair of the political science department here at University of California, Santa Barbara. I'm delighted to welcome all of you, distinguished guests, faculty, and students, to this forum on historical memories and the resurgence of nationalism in Asia. Following some introductory remarks by Dean David Marshall and me, the evening will be devoted to presentations by a distinguished panel who will discuss some of the important and controversial issues that faced Asia and the world as we construct a new politics in the post-Cold War era. Following the presentations by our panelists, there will be a period of questions from the audience. First, I want to introduce David Marshall, Dean of Humanities and Fine Arts and Executive Dean of the College of Letters and Sciences at University of California, Santa Barbara, to bring us greetings. David.
Thank you. Melvin Oliver, Dean of Social Science, was at the reception earlier but couldn't be here tonight. And I'm very glad to be here on behalf of the college to welcome you. This is an exciting conference. We're very pleased by the turnout. I gather there are scholars here from not only the United States, from Japan and China, South Korea and Norway, and probably elsewhere as well. And we're very glad to have this cooperative venture across the college, the Center for Cold War Studies, the Department of Political Science, and other departments that are here today. And I'm grateful not only to the organizers of the conference, but especially to Ambassador Togo, who really helped, I think, create the vision for what this conference is about. I'm struck by the combination in the title of the conference of historical memories and reconciliation. John Woolley predicted that I would have some juicy quotes, and a few did come to mind. I thought of the famous comment by George Orwell that history is written by the winners, and there's a complimentary quote by the Southern American writer Lillian Smith, "The winner names the age." And it seems to me that historians understand why the past is worth fighting over, and reconciliation today may depend on our success not only in understanding history, but in writing history, in telling the stories about the past that define our present and that define our future. And the participants, I think, in this conference no doubt would agree with the words of another Southern novelist, William Faulkner, who wrote famously, "The past is not dead. In fact, it's not even past." So in that effort to engage with the past and its ever-present quality, I wish you the best of luck. I think this is going to be a really interesting and indeed important series of discussions that you'll be having, and I look forward to hearing about it and eventually reading about it and the publications which will probably emanate from these discussions for many years. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Dean Marshall. This evening would not be possible without, in the first instance, the Public Policymaker in Residence program founded and guided by the Dean of Social Sciences, Melvin Oliver. As David said, Dean Oliver couldn't be here tonight, but he does convey his greetings. 2 years ago, in order to better realize his vision, a vision most of us share, of a university that addresses important contemporary policy problems, Dean Oliver launched the Public Policymaker in Residence program. Each visiting policymaker is asked, in addition to their many other responsibilities, to organize a conference to address a contemporary issue. We've been extremely pleased that it was possible to appoint Ambassador Togo as our second public policymaker in residence. While Ambassador Togo has been officially housed in the Political Science Department, his appointment, as you have heard, was a cooperative effort that reached across the campus to involve three departments, two deans, and a major research center. This is a classic reflection of UCSB's interdisciplinarity. As a specialist in American politics, I want to make two quick observations about the topic of historical memory and the challenge of Japanese reconciliation with its Asian partners. First, the problem of unresolved historical grievances is not peculiar to the Japanese, and the kinds of issues to be discussed here tonight and their possible solutions have widespread relevance. In American politics, race and racial divisions are probably the most enduring and troubling aspects of our political life, and we have by no means reconciled on these issues. What we're about to hear is sure to resonate with our American experience. Second, Americans famously have little information about most countries in the world. Japan is no exception. For example, we Americans do not know the name of the Japanese prime minister. And if we should encounter it, we pronounce it to sound like the first name of our most famous president, Abe. So for most Americans, and perhaps for many of us at the university, the details of the controversies to be discussed here tonight will be unfamiliar and thus especially interesting. And I would say to the panel, don't assume too much. At this point, I'd like to turn things over to my colleague, Professor Hasegawa, professor of history, director of the Center for Cold War Studies here at UCSB. He has a very distinguished scholarly career, and his recent book, Racing the Enemy, Stalin, Truman, and the Surrender of Japan, has been honored already with two prizes. Professor Hasegawa will introduce our panelists and moderate the balance of the evening's discussion. Toshi.
Thank you, Joe. Before I introduce tonight's panelists, I would like to thank a couple of institutions and a couple of people. First of all, this event and next 2 days conference is funded by U.S.-Japan foundations along with social science division and the UCIGCC. So I thank those organizations. And also that one more person that I like to mention, that is one person who could not be here, that's our Chancellor Henry Yang. Every time I bumped into him, says, Toshi, what's going on in Japan and Asia? And he's vitally interested in this topic, and I'm sure that he wished that he were here. Okay, today is my name is Toshi Hasegawa. I'm the, the title is co-director, not director, and our better half is sitting over there, Salim Yaqub. Our first speaker is Gilbert Rosman. It is a great pleasure to introduce Gil. We are friends for over 20 years. And finally, I managed to bring him over here because I'm so pleased. He is really the foremost authority in East Asian affairs. He's a Musgrave Professor of Sociology. He has numerous books. He reads Russian, Chinese, Japanese, and Korean. And his English is not that bad either. He has numerous books, and I'm not going to read, but the most dealing with Russo-Japanese relations, Sino-Soviet relations, Korean nuclear issues. He has recently edited the book Russia's Strategy, Strategic Thought Towards Asia and Japan's Strategy towards Strategic Thought in Asia. He's now editing Korea's Strategic Thought in Asia, and he's as if this is not enough, he's writing a book on the nuclear issues in Korea. So please welcome Gil Rosman.
Thank you very much for that overly generous introduction. My challenge, inspired by our two organizers who themselves range widely in their treatment of East Asia in terms of historical periods and countries, is to think broadly about what is the history issue in its contemporary perspective. What should we say about this issue that is much discussed, but generally quite narrowly in specifics? And we'll have plenty of time in our conference over the next 2 days to talk about the specifics. So I want to put this in a really broad light, and I'm glad to have the opportunity to rethink what's happening in this region. I would start with the Confucian tradition, which, of course, was the dominant intellectual tradition in China, in Korea, and in Japanese education and Japanese elites for much of the latter imperial history of these countries or recent history before the West arrived. And what we see is in Confucianism a tremendous emphasis on the importance of history. History as a moral compass, as a source of legitimacy, as a sort of basis for your identity. You have to get the history right. And when a new dynasty came in China, it had to rewrite the history in a certain fashion to justify what it was going to do to contrast with the past. But in Japan, this was a more long-term perspective about history. And in any case, the idea of history, I think, is associated with the idea of legitimacy today and national identity and also saving face and earning respect. And this, we may not think of these things in the same way in our background, but I think we should recognize its importance in East Asia. And then Japan changed everything. Beginning in the 1890s, it became the dominant country in East Asia, and it operated in terms of the so-called realpolitik, or the sense that it was in a new world fighting with countries, many of which were imperialist, fighting for control of territory and influence, and this was a transitional period between the 1890s and 1945 when Japan sort of set the pace for what was happening in East Asia. And yet, I think even though it was operating without this same moral historical compass, there was still a sense that history would be the ultimate judge, and it wanted to prove itself by making sure that what it was doing was recognized as legal or just from its own perspective. And so history remains as the decider as to the final battleground in assessing this period where Japan dominated. After the war, we had to face the recognition of what happened during those previous decades, and it had to be faced with Japan, not just separately. Every country, of course, came up with its own explanations for why the war was fought, what were the factors that caused Japan to attack Pearl Harbor, to invade China, and so on. But this had to be done by the Japanese themselves and in conjunction with other countries. And I don't think this issue was handled well, primarily for two reasons in the post-war era. One was because the United States was dominant. The United States doesn't pay as much attention to historical themes, and the United States soon had different priorities. We were concerned about the victory of communism in China, about the Soviet threat, and the Korean War came quickly. And so our interest in Japan switched abruptly, reducing the pressure on Japan to satisfy the occupying country and then their ally. In addition, much of the discussion took place in a Marxist-Leninist framework. Even in Japan, a lot of the writing came from this framework, and it didn't deal with the issues in the fashion we are accustomed to from careful history and examining the discourse of what was being said and what was perceived. In fact, it was rather formulaic, class warfare, interest of imperialist and victim countries. It was really not an adequate way of dealing with this. And so we didn't end up with a real understanding that would be able to resolve the history issues in the post-war era in a fashion that would be satisfactory. So there were additional tests that loomed after the San Francisco Peace Treaty of 1951, which wasn't involving the major countries of Asia. It involved Japan and the United States above all, and therefore it didn't have to deal with some of these problems in the way that would have been necessary had Japan really made peace with its major victims. And so one test would be normalization of relations. Another test would be, after normalization, what would happen when you get past the Cold War and you have to talk about how do you recognize these historical anniversaries, how do you commemorate them and work together with your neighbors. And the third test, it seems to me, when you try to create some kind of regional framework for regionalism and for a security framework, how do you interpret the cultural issues and the historical issues in this context? So it's these three tests that we've only had to deal with since the 1960s. Now, the first process, normalization, worked out in a way, I think, that didn't prove sufficient. And it occurred because the countries with which Japan normalized, at the time it normalized, were all in abnormal situations. South Korea in 1965, very late normalization, should have happened much earlier. And when it did happen, we had a dictator in South Korea who was afraid he was illegitimate. He needed help from Japan. He was afraid that North Korea's economy was developing much quicker and the gap between North and South Korea would threaten the survival of his country. The United States was pressuring during the Vietnam War Japan and South Korea to work together, two allies that couldn't even normalize their own relations. South Korea was desperate for the economic assistance that Japan now could provide after its own decade of double-digit economic growth. And so this was an abnormal situation that didn't prove satisfactory to the South Korean people, gave Japan false hopes about how it could go on to normalize with other countries. And it wasn't really normalization, because the leaders of the two countries couldn't even visit each other because of the hostility being expressed at this time. It took until the 1980s before there could be regular meetings at the summit level. But nonetheless, it set the pattern. And then China came along in 1972 in the aftermath of Richard Nixon's historic visit. Japan essentially had to follow the U.S. example and normalize with China, but China was pretty desperate on its own accord, and its two priorities were dealing with the Taiwan issue so that Japan would switch recognition and Taiwan would be isolated and China could further the process of reunification, and dealing with the Soviet threat, because they turned to the United States really as a realist solution, thinking that they had a very big problem with the Soviet Union. Under these circumstances, again, Japan got a good deal. Again, China decided not to really talk much about history and not to demand much of an apology. And Japan could say, look, we normalized and we can go on from there. And China will need us for economics for a long time to come. And we're going to, later when there was the peace treaty signed near the end of the 70s between China and Japan, and they didn't really resolve their main territorial dispute, but China postponed dealing with it. And Japan, at this point, could count on China's need for development assistance and the economic ties. So again, we have China with a foreign threat, China with U.S. pressure, example in the U.S. pressure, and Japan thinking it's getting a pretty good deal in these circumstances. And by the early 80s then, Japan seems to be riding very high. Its economy is doing extremely well. It thinks it's cleared up the problems with China, with South Korea and China for the most part, and it's making new close connections with the leaders of these countries under Prime Minister Nakasone. Relations with South Korea and China look like they're moving into a new level, a new dimension. But in fact, behind the scenes, other things are happening, and this is not going to work out well. The democracy movement in South Korea is beginning to bring public opinion in, and South Korea's prosperity is reducing the economic significance of Japan, and China is beginning to have student demonstrations. The Chinese party leader who made these deals with Nakasone seemed to be improving relations, was ousted from power after there were demonstrations, in part relating to his ties to Japan. So we have a situation where normalization is completed with every country but North Korea. It's still not completed there. And yet Japan is really squandering its best chance to build on this foundation, to understand what is full-scale normalization, to recognize how to go to the next stage of normalization. And we're beginning to see, although they're not always detected, cracks behind this facade. And so this is where the history issue begins getting more serious. We get into the 1990s, and now Japan has to deal with the post-Cold War world. The threat situation has changed. The U.S. Pressure and U.S. Example has changed. Japan's economic predominance is being reduced, particularly with its economic stagnation. And now there are these memorial visits, the 20th anniversary of normalization, or so on. The 40th anniversary of the end of the war, the 50th anniversary of the end of the war. And what do you do on these occasions? How do you recognize these occasions and build relations up? And I think that some of the leaders of East Asia were saying to Japan, we would like to solve these problems because we have things we want to accomplish with you. And so the last three presidents of South Korea have each come to office with the goal of improving relations with Japan and reducing the role of the history issue. And each of them has been frustrated because that didn't happen. The two sides could not reach an understanding. Even when they thought they reached an understanding, as in 1998, it proved to be not sufficient. And in China's case, we've seen over the last 8 years repeated efforts to try to overcome the history issue after it got out of hand in 1995 to 1998. So we had smile diplomacy from the Chinese government in 1999. We have new thinking from the Chinese government towards Japan in 2002. And now we've got the Wen Jiabao, the prime minister of China, just visited Japan, and he gave a very forward-looking, very upbeat speech to the Diet, emphasizing how relations should improve. And so we've got real efforts to improve things, and we also have the possibility of North Korea, after Koizumi's visit of 2002, agreeing to normalize relations and dealing with the history issue in a fashion not unlike the way South Korea did earlier. But somehow things have not gone in the somewhat hopeful direction that still appeared possible just a few years ago. And there's now a question of, are the problems just occasional ones that can be overcome? This is a kind of a cyclical pattern. Or are we really into a long-term downturn where we don't have answers? And that means we really have to go back and figure out what the causes are of these difficulties. And we have to see what is the link-up between the history issue and other issues, including the security issue, which has become a big deal in East Asia with the North Korean nuclear program and with the which threatens Japan more than anyone else, and with the Chinese very rapid military buildup and uncertainty about the military balance in this part of the world. As countries talk about regional trust and regionalism, what does this mean for incorporating the history issue? And so I would argue that these issues are bound together now. You can't solve one without dealing with some of the others. That it's very unlikely that history by itself will produce some kind of resolution. And it seems to me that on the Japanese side, the reason the history issue has been coming up more, more disregard for what their neighbors think. For instance, when Prime Minister Koizumi went repeatedly to the Yasukuni Shrine, although that was something that was clearly regarded as a challenge, and it led to no high-level meetings with the leaders of China. So where will we go to overcome this issue, which involves textbooks and who caused the discussion about how did the war start, how were the wars fought, what was the purpose of Japan's imperialist controls in the region, including over Korea? What were some of the lingering issues? Has Japan apologized enough? There are a whole series of these themes. And if we go and look at them, it seems to me we have to say that they reflect right now, from the Japanese point of view, great deal of anxiety about a security situation that's deteriorated rapidly and unexpectedly, and they're not prepared for. And they have to overcome some of this anxiety in order to have a more forthright discussion about how to deal with the history issue in a different fashion. They also reflect the confusion between two ways of changing Japan, making it a more normal country. One is realism, recognizing that Japan can't be so militarily weak that it just depends on the United States and watches as military problems intensify in the area, doesn't satisfy the United States' desire for a strong military ally, and doesn't satisfy Japanese people's desire to be able to do more in the face of their own uncertain environment. So that's the realist side. And that seems to me very natural, normal, that Japan should move in that direction. On the other hand, there is the revisionist side that says Japan at last can reinterpret its history in a way that will satisfy its needs. And some suggest that goes along with the notion of a beautiful Japan that Abe, is the prime minister, is discussing. And if that's the case, what does it mean if you have an ugly history in part to call your country a beautiful country? How do you deal with that? Can you put that history aside and say, we know that was only a small part of our history and we can live with that? And or do you have to try to make that history different than the way it's been interpreted generally over the last decades, and make it into something that's more compatible with a beautiful image and make it more complicated for your neighbors and maybe for even eventually for the United States? Because after all, the history issue is not just between Japan and East Asia. It's also, in essence, between Japan and the United States, because we were enemies in that war period. So my conclusion then is that it's critical to create an atmosphere where we're addressing the security issues of this region. And right now, the central issue is the North Korean nuclear program and the six-party talks. And how can we coordinate so that the countries involved in this crisis are putting pressure together on North Korea to give up its nuclear program, to greatly reduce its threat capacity, at the same time where we are working together to engage North Korea, and as some of the countries insist must be done, in order to show that there's a way forward that'll be appealing for the people of that country and will give it an option to encourage it to really go forward and agree to these terms. Well, in February, we had a program for solving this crisis, a new way of treating it. The United States changed its position, and the U.S. and Japan were not really working together on that. That's created a lot of nervousness in Japan. They have not fully accepted and the way this is moving forward, and so this is not a step towards resolving our problems. We have to get back on the same wavelength in dealing with North Korea as just one of the issues in order to create the foundation for solving the history issue. I'll stop there. Thank you.
Thank you, Gil. The next speaker is Ambassador Togo. It's really a great pleasure to introduce Ambassador Togo, my good colleague and good friend. His grandfather was Shigenori Togo, who happened to be Japan's foreign minister when Japan attacked Pearl Harbor, and also he was the foreign minister of Japan when Japan surrendered. His father was ambassador to the United States, and so that he was from diplomatic family. And he entered Ministry of Foreign Affairs in 1968. He was the director of Soviet desk, and eventually the director general of the European and Oceanic Affairs Bureau. As such, he was the architect of Japan's policy towards the Soviet Union. And also, he was ambassador of Japan to the Netherlands, and then after he retired from the foreign ministry, he became also he worked on Japan's relations with East Asia. He has a book of Japan's foreign policy, 1945 to 2003, and he was a co-editor with Gil Rosman of Russia's strategic thought towards Asia and Japan's strategic thought towards Asia. Ambassador Togo.
Professor Hasegawa, thank you very much for the warm introduction. And Professor Rosman, thank you very much for the very interesting and illuminating presentation. In the 2 years that I have stayed in Princeton, I have always admired Gil's lecture, which I attended several times, in his ability of describing things in this broadest viewpoints of international relations. And tonight, it was such a pleasure to listen to your lecture once again. I think you have put in real good light the issue of historical memory, which Japan faces in this broad historical and contemporary perspectives. And also, I think Gil presented some of the inherent limitations, why Japan is not able to overcome the historical memory issue. Now, to supplement his lecture, tonight I would like to concentrate on specifics and explain two things. First, what is the reason? Why Japan is not able to overcome the historical issues, my own perspective. And then the second issue, then where are we going? Are we just drifted? Or is there any directions toward which Japan is moving in overcoming historical memory issues? Now, firstly, why is it so difficult for Japan to overcome historical issues? And for this, we have to go back more than 60 years ago to summer 1945, when Japan got this complete defeat. It was the first time in history that Japan was ever defeated by a foreign country. This created a tremendous rupture between its past and present. Japan lost what it has accumulated from Meiji restorations until 1945. And there emerged huge spiritual vacuum. In this spiritual vacuum, many Japanese accepted new values. It was a time of occupation, and the United States brought in new values. And so peace, democracy, and some preservation of imperial tradition, and concentrated effort toward economic reconstruction became the new direction of the era. In doing so, Japan accepted the consequence of defeat. There were two pillars. One was the war criminals tribunal. Class A war criminals were judged in 1945. 25 were indicted, 7 were hanged. And there were war criminals tribunals for Class B and C, and about 1,000 soldiers and generals were executed. Japan accepted this judgment in the San Francisco Peace Treaty. The second pillar was the network of international agreement and treaties, to start with San Francisco Peace Treaty, which resolved all war-related issues, claims and reparation and so forth. And that's with Korea, as mentioned, 1965, and with China in 1972. But because the spiritual vacuum which split Japan in summer 1948 was so deep, there emerged certain contradictions. This was a contradiction between those who maintained that everything which Japan did before the war, from Meiji to 1945, was wrong. It was a very serious intellectual direction which governed then Japan in the post-war decades. And another, those who maintained that, yeah, we did something wrong. But to argue that everything which Japan did from Meiji Restoration to 1945, this goes too much. And this tension between these two intellectual political forces split Japanese society, and this contradiction runs to this date. Now, the second issue. Then, is Japan just adrift? Or is there a certain direction in Japan to overcome this dichotomy? And I argue, that despite these tensions, there is a certain direction toward which Japan is moving. In the Hegelian dialectics, there is a thesis, antithesis. Then there are issues where Japan is detecting some synthesis. And among the 8 issues related to historical memory, I argue that at least there are 5 issues where Japan managed to find some synthesis. 3, not yet. Now, so I want to run down very quickly those 5, those 8 issues. First, apology. In the post-war period, there were intellectuals, opinion leaders, politicians who argued very strongly that basically the Japanese policy from Meiji to World War II was a mistake. But on the other hand, particularly from the 60s, there emerged some other historians, scholars, who argued that, well, basically we are fighting an imperialist war in accordance with the then existing international law. Atrocities were committed, but soldiers were punished. No need for further apology. Now, the government, in this process of reconsideration, took a new attitude of moral evaluation. And that was best expressed in Prime Minister Murayama's statement in 1995, in which he said that, "I express my feelings of deep remorse and state my heartfelt apology to the tremendous damage and suffering caused by Japan through its colonial rule and aggression to the people of many countries, particularly to those of Asian nations, 1995. This statement became the basic policy line of the government since then. Prime Minister Koizumi, in 2005, in the conference at Bandung, in front of the whole Asian African leaders, practically word by word confirmed this position, and this is inherited by current government under Abe. In relation to China, we have the 1992 imperial visit. In relation to Korea, we have the 1998 Kim Dae-jung's visit, which was both a very important occasion for Japan to express our contrition. This is the thesis based on this very difficult tension between this thesis and antithesis, which is emerging in Japan. Now, second, comfort women issue. There are those intellectuals, opinion leaders, lawyers, and other social leaders who maintain in Japan that basically comfort women system was a system of mass rape, and that the government should bear responsibility to this. Now, there are others who maintain that the comfort women system was a system of military brothels run by civilian brokers, and extremely unfortunate things happened, but to persecute Japan on their state responsibility goes too much. The position of the government between these thesis and antithesis was expressed by then General Secretary Kono, in 1993, in which he stated that the then Japanese military was involved in the establishment and management of the comfort stations and transfer of comfort women. And he expressed sincere apologies and remorse to all those who suffered immeasurable pain and incurable physical and psychological wounds. And based on this statement, 2 years later, Japan established this Asian Women Fund, in accordance with which 285 former comfort women from Korea, Taiwan, and Philippines, and 79 Dutch former comfort women received an atonement of about $18,000, accompanied with a sincere letter of apology by Prime Minister. Now, Prime Minister Abe, despite recent confusion, recently stated that he expressed deep-hearted sympathies for the extreme hardship and apologies to have put these women in that sort of circumstances. Third, Nanjing Massacre. The Nanjing Massacre was first brought to Japanese attention in the Tokyo Tribunal. We're told that about 200,000 Chinese were massacred, and this number now reached 300,000 in accordance with Chinese official positions. In Japan, there are certain scholars who maintain that, who seriously question about these numbers. But total denial of Nanjing Massacre is a real minority view in present-day Japan. In 1985, Japan's Army Veterans Association, Kaikosha, published the result of their research. Admittedly, the estimated number with which they came was 13,000. However, in publishing this outcome, they stated, "We apologize deeply to the people of China. We say again, 13,000 naturally, and even our minimum figure of 3,000 is an astonishingly huge number. We began our work of checking the military history, knowing that we were not completely clean, but with this huge number, we simply have no words. Whatever the severity of war or specificity of war psychology, we just lose words faced with this mass illegal killing. As those who are related to the pre-war military, we simply apologize deeply to the people of China. It was truly regrettable act of barbarity. This is sort of basic feeling shared by most of the Japanese who are interested in this matter. Forced labor. Historical facts are contested, but in September 2044, it's generally recognized that on government order, 220,000 Koreans were transferred to Japan. On China, in 1942, there was a cabinet decision which transferred 40,000 Chinese to the Japanese companies or various sites. In 1990s, because of the hardship those workers had to suffer, they waged many court cases in Japan. Now, on 27th of April 2007, just a month ago, the Supreme Court of Japan made an extremely important ruling. All claims by those enforced laborers were rejected on the basis of the international treaties which Japan concluded, which waived claims not only by the government but also by their nationals. This was the interpretation which our Supreme Court reached 27th of April this year. However, in coming to this closure of the judicial solution, Supreme Court also stated that the mental and physical pain incurred was extremely serious, whereas the company gained profit from the forced labor. So the company concerned and other entities involved in this matter must make efforts to save the victims. We are in crossroads. But here our direction is clearly shown, that those companies which are now freed from the possibility of legal persecution could deploy further initiative to resolve this issue from the moral point of view. Naturally, the direction which the government would show has certain importance. Now, lastly, about these five issues, textbooks. Post-war scholars and historians maintain in Japan that there are far too little description of the atrocities committed. And Ienaga Saburo was the hero of this direction, who waged for 32 years court cases against the government. But conservative scholars took an entirely different position, and they recently published two textbooks, as we know, from Sosha 2001 and 2005, underlying Japanese honor and the righteousness of pre-war activities. But this is the reflection of this internal polarization on this issue, a real example of post-war Japan's contradiction. Criticism from China and Korea on this Fusosa's textbooks is vehement. My hope in this area lies in the recently started dialogues between Japan and Korea and China. In Korea, we've started in 2002. With China, we've started this dialogue last year. Now, three issues about which we have not found synthesis. First, question of war responsibility. Murayama, Koizumi, and all our prime ministers acknowledge that some wrongdoings have been done. But then, who was responsible? On this issue, there's no answer. Recently, there was a commendable effort by Asahi Shimbun, Yomiuri Shimbun, trying to analyze and come to a conclusion of our own. And yet, we have not reached any national consensus on this issue. Second, Yasukuni Shrine issue, an extremely complicated issue. But one issue in Yasukuni related to the enshrinement of Class A war criminals. China maintains very clearly that because those Class A war criminals were the leaders of the war of aggression to China, going to Yasukuni and mourn the war dead would imply mourning for those who led the war. Therefore, it's not acceptable. The solution so far discussed was either de-enshrine or de-enshrine Class A criminals or create a new neutral monument. Neither is accepted by those Yasukuni supporters. Present-day Abe's policy, Prime Minister Abe's policy, is policy of no confirmation, no denial, meaning that he will not acknowledge whether he has gone or he has not gone to Yasukuni Shrine. But naturally, this undeclared period for moratorium cannot last forever. And what is going to happen afterwards? No answer. Lastly, there is one issue, Unit 731. Now, it is common knowledge in Japan and elsewhere that in 1939, this Unit 731 was established in northern part of Manchu, engaged in biological warfare experiments, using about 3,000 Chinese prisoners for human experiments. After the war, apparently there was a kind of agreement between the occupying forces and the leadership of this unit that all information on biological warfare will be transmitted to the U.S. side in exchange of not indicting these people. But soldiers belonging to 731 began to speak about in 1982. A book called Devil's Gluttony was published in Japan, which became a huge bestseller in Japan. So this became a common knowledge in Japan. Now, has not time come for my government to at least acknowledge and apologize, naturally with close consultation with the government of the United States? Now, in conclusion, I argue that apology is basically an action, one-way action. I mean, you apologize because you think that you did something wrong. You do not condition apology of whether the apology is accepted or not. I think this is a moral principle. This is accepted in a personal relation, but I think this is a moral principle which Japan should abide itself. But reconciliation is different. Reconciliation is two ways. I just want to conclude my presentation by quoting two latest examples, one in relation to China. The speech which Professor Rosman mentioned, made by Prime Minister Wen Jiabao, on the 12th of April at our parliament. Since the establishment of diplomatic relations, the Japanese government and Japanese leaders expressed many times their position in history, officially acknowledged aggression, expressed deep remorse and apology toward victim countries. The Chinese government and people positively appreciate this position. On Korea, one example I want to quote is Professor Park Yuha, who has studied Japanese and Japanese literature, teaching in Korea, who, while making very, very correct criticism, objective criticism on Japan, also make a very, in our view, objective and impartial analysis on Korean attitudes toward Japan. The translated book is attracting a lot of attention in Japan. Lastly, United States. Because the United States was the country with which we fought war 60 years ago and lost, if one comes to the deep analysis of the historical memory, United States cannot stay away, stay outside. But it is my deep conviction that any discussions which we may have on this issue should be conducted in the line of consolidation of our alliance relationship. And the fact that the University of California, Santa Barbara, is giving us this opportunity to hold this symposium of historical memory, maybe is a real sign of contribution on the part of the United States. Thank you very much.
The It's my great pleasure to introduce the commentator today. That's Mike Mochizuki. Mike Mochizuki is a professor of Elliott School of George Washington University. He has endowed chair of Japan-U.S. relations in memory of Gaston Segura. He teaches Japanese politics and foreign policy and U.S.-Japan relations, East Asian security. He has recently wrote, the publications include Japan Between Alliance and Autonomy, Strategic Thinking Under Bush and Koizumi, Implications for U.S.-Japan Alliance. He also wrote the book Crisis on the Korean Peninsula, How to Deal with Nuclear North Korea. Also, New Strategic Triangle, the U.S.-Japan Alliance and the Rise of China, and many others. So, Mike?
Thank you very much. It really is an honor to share this podium with three people that I admire and have such respect for, Professor Hasegawa, Professor Rossman, and Ambassador Togo. And as you can tell from their very rich presentations, it's very difficult to give comments, and I know I don't want to stand in the way of giving you an opportunity to ask Professor Rossman and Ambassador Togo questions. So what I will do is just limit myself to three basic points. And I think from what you've heard, the presentations by Professor Rossman and Ambassador Togo complement each other very well. Professor Rossman has given you the broader historical and regional context in which to think about the history issue, and Ambassador Togo has looked into the details of the Japanese debate about history and in explaining why it has been so difficult for Japan to come to grips with its militarist past. Now, although there is, I think, a lot of agreement between both of them, I just want to highlight what I see as a slight difference in terms of nuance and approach. Ambassador Togo has stressed the polarization in the debate, but he gives a hopeful message, a Hegelian message, that out of this polarization there might be some kind of synthesis, and so he holds out the prospect for a reconciliation within Japan that might then provide the basis for Japan's further reconciliation with its neighbors. Professor Rossman, I think, is more pessimistic, and in fact, in his written remarks, is very clearly more pessimistic. Rather than the possibility of progress, he talks about Japan's move to overturn historical verdicts, and he says that things are likely to get worse before they get better. So, whereas Ambassador Togo feels there's a possibility of progress out of this polarization and an emergence of a synthesis, Professor Rossman sees the danger of retrogression. Well, I guess the question that I have to both of them is to Ambassador Togo, this possibility of progress is something that I also hold, but I wonder whether that kind of progress is at all possible under a liberal democratic party government. I mean, when I look at kind of the what you call as the major turning point in the way Japan has dealt with this history issue, the Murayama Statement of 1995, the statement that Prime Minister Koizumi almost recited word for word, would that kind of statement have been possible under a Liberal Democratic Party government? In other words, the LDP prime ministers subsequently have all embraced this Danwa, but when one looks at the origins of this 1995 statement, It was a statement issued by a socialist prime minister, Mr. Murayama, and that statement got cabinet endorsement only because he threatened to pull the plug out of the government that brought the LDP back into power. And in fact, for me, the beginning of Japan's moving towards greater reconciliation with its neighbors begins with the fall of the LDP from power and the emergence of the Hosokawa government. And I still remember vividly his first press conference of Prime Minister Hosokawa. When asked by the press, he says unequivocally, yes, that was a war of aggression. And there was a big nationalistic backlash, but it was precisely because he was not an LDP prime minister that he could bring such candor into the discussion of the history issue. Now to Professor Rosman, the question is about the danger of retrogression. And this is the flip side, that maybe things aren't as bad as they seem, because even Prime Minister Abe, who is probably the most conservative prime minister in Japan since Prime Minister Nakasone, has managed, even though in his heart he may not believe in the Kono statement, he has accepted the Kono statement. He has accepted the Murayama statement, and although he did not necessarily follow the advice of Ambassador Togo and declared a moratorium on Yasukuni Shrine visits, he has followed through a neither confirmed nor denied policy an undeclared moratorium of Yasukuni. So in a sense, there's a stasis here. And why is that stasis insufficient? I mean, why not just keep that kind of ambiguous position and stick with the Murayama Danwa, the Murayama statement, the Kono statement, and this undeclared moratorium? I mean, what is it that necessitates Japan from going further? So even under Abe, at least you're holding the line. So those are a couple questions that emerged in my mind when I was listening to our two speakers. The second issue is an issue that Ambassador Togo raised, and it's the role of the United States. And I think that's a very important issue. I was asked this question when I was just speaking yesterday at the University of California, San Diego, about this very question. And the question relates to what really is America's interest in this question, in this history issue. And one questioner raised the possibility that maybe the United States really does not want true reconciliation between Japan and East Asia. It's in the United States' interest not to have a war between Japan and the East Asian countries that could suck the United States in, but perhaps a certain amount of tension between Japan and East Asia may be to the advantage of the United States, because then the Japanese have to turn to the Americans and form a robust alliance, and Japan would not be able to participate in an East Asian order that excludes the United States. My answer to that was that given, I think, the ultimate convergence of interests and values between the United States and Japan, that indeed the United States wants Japan to be influential and respected in East Asia, because without a respected and influential Japan, then U.S. interests cannot be promoted. But I would like to hear from our presenters to what extent they see of whether or not the United States really has a deep interest in this historical issue. Another issue is regarding the controversial resolution that was proposed by Representative Michael Honda of California. I don't know if you're all familiar with the resolution, but this is a non-binding resolution that Representative Honda has proposed to the U.S. Congress. He's proposed earlier versions a couple of times, and they never have come to a vote. But it's a resolution asking Japan to give an unequivocal official apology to the comfort women. I mean, he does not consider the Kono statement to be an unequivocal official apology. Unlike the Murayama statement, the Kono statement does not have the full force of a cabinet decision or an endorsement. If you think in terms of various government statements, I mean, of course, the Kono statement is much more than a press secretary, a White House press secretary statement, but it does not have the weight of one of a resolution of the National Diet, and nor does it have the weight of the Murayama statement. So the question is, should the United States, really get involved in this issue in this way? Is the Honda resolution, whether it passes or not passes, is this kind of action something that is counterproductive, that ultimately undermines U.S.-Japan relations, or is it a positive thing? In other words, is it a warning from a friend that Japan really needs to do more on this particular issue? And then finally, on the U.S. robe, Ambassador Togo stated it eloquently. I could not agree with him more, that ultimately the United States is so deeply involved in this issue that the United States ought to play a role. But if the United States plays a role, there are some issues left hanging between the United States and Japan. I know that American POWs that were mistreated by the Japanese still feel that they have not gotten the apology that they deserve. And there is a continuing movement to get that kind of clear apology from the Japanese government. But then what about the American firebombings of Tokyo, in which the United States purposely targeted Japanese civilians in the war? Or what about the atomic bombings of Nagasaki and Hiroshima? So it seems to me that if the United States is truly to get engaged in this issue, it also has to reflect on its own past. And I remember when I arrived in Washington, it was very difficult for the Smithsonian Institute to even give a balanced view of the controversy regarding the atomic bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. So you can understand how difficult this issue of addressing the past is. Finally, the final point is regarding the relationship between the history issue and broader regional trends and security. And I think Professor Rosman is exactly right that this is not a narrow issue about history. It's about the future regional security order. And I would probably emphasize the point that Professor Rosman alluded to, that it really is the Cold War strategic calculations that drove the nature of what he calls the normalization process. I would refer to it as a thin state-to-state or government-to-government reconciliation. And I think the model for that was not so much the Japan ROK, but it was really the U.S.-Japan San Francisco Peace Treaty. And then immediately following that is the 1952 post-war settlement between Japan and the Republic of China. And it's that boxes in the People's Republic of China in 1972, because then the Chinese, mainland China, could not then demand war reparations from Japan. But that thin state-to-state reconciliation, in my view, is becoming much less tenable, and it is probably now unavoidable to try to reach for this, what Professor Rosman calls full-scale normalization, what I would call kind of thicker or deeper society-to-society reconciliation. And that's because of not only the security uncertainties and the changing balance of power in the region, but because of democratization. But the problem that I see is that, and this goes back then to Ambassador Togo and the debate in Japan, is that, as I see it, right now the debate splits along two camps. One is the camp in which you have people who feel that Japan needs to develop a much more robust security relationship with the United States for Japan to become a normal actor in international security affairs. And it's precisely these people who then tend to embrace a conservative revisionist view of history. And those who take a much more reflective and critical view of Japanese history tend to be the pacifists who are much more reluctant to embrace the United States in terms of joint defense operations and much more committed to defending the current pacifist constitution. Unfortunately, what we do not see in Japan is a loud voice. I think there are some people who represent that. In fact, there are some people in this room who represent that voice. And it's the voice of those who want Japan to contribute more actively to international security, but also want Japan to come to grips with the history issue. So the normalization of Japan as a security actor, on the one hand, going hand in hand with historical reconciliation. I mean, I feel that that's the only way that Japan can normalize as a security actor and be a positive contribution to regional security rather than a negative contribution. But the unfortunate thing is that that voice is still a very weak voice in Japanese domestic politics. Thank you.
Just to move it in a more theoretical frame, which is probably the only contribution I'll be able to make at this conference, not knowing anything, I'm afraid, about the specifics of the area. And this is a question of clarification for Professor Rossman. As I understand your presentation, what you're using is essentially a security or realist lens to provide a useful way to understand why these historical problems have emerged now in the manner that they've emerged. But I wonder if that lens is really a necessary lens or even a sufficient lens to explain what's going on. As I understand these issues and the language that's being used in these issues, these are questions that raise matters of right and wrong, victims versus perpetrators. It's a moral language. Perhaps it's a language of identity. It's certainly a language of justice. And so the question that I'm raising here is, do you think that if the security issues were resolved, if the regional security issues in some sense were tamped down, that these other questions of reconciliation would just sort of go away?
When I brought up the security issues, my purpose was to say why I think they have become exacerbated, one of the factors. I also consider uncertainties about national identity, growing sense that the world is more complicated, Japan's role in Asia is less clear, Japan's model of development and model of international relations has not proven to emerge the way it was expected to. So it seems to me there are a variety of things operating in these circumstances. I don't think if we solve the security issues, we solve the identity problems, and that the right wing in Japan, it seems to me, will not be satisfied just with a calm environment. But I do think if we keep the security issues in the forefront and they're not settled, the other issues are going to be more difficult to settle.
I think this will follow Peter's question back to you, Professor Rossman. You use the term normalization frequently in your presentation, and I'm aware of it, or I think of it as a term of diplomacy. And then later you talked about Japan becoming normal at one point, and I thought, what's normal? Could you talk a little bit about or expand a bit about what normal means? I mean, does it mean, for example, that if you're an empire, an ex-empire, you have to admit you should never have had the empire in the first place, or what?
Of course, I use the term normalization to refer to the diplomatic relations that were established with countries in Asia, and then to the follow-up to extend that to provide a fuller kind of normalization beyond diplomacy. But the term normal, becoming a normal state, has been a term widely used in Japan. I think Ozawa Ichiro brought it up early in the 1990s, and there has been this sense that this is Japan's goal. But just as you've said, it's a complicated term, and you're wondering what it means. Everybody else is trying to figure out what it means. It's not an unambiguous term in Japan. And so there are many interpretations of what it means in terms of having pride in your country, believing in a beautiful Japan, as Abe puts it, being able to deal with foreign countries in a different way, being able to stand up for your own security in a different way. So these multiple themes are debatable, and I don't want to suggest now that I have an answer that others haven't provided.
Okay, we have to close it in a few minutes, so I'll take one last question.
Yes.
I have two comments/questions for our three speakers. The first one is that from my experience of growing up in China and living in China, my sense is that this grievances and resentment that Chinese hold against the Japanese did not only start from the World War II. It actually went back in the history. If you go to school in China, you will surely learn about how the Japanese monks and students came to China, learned the language, learned the culture during the Tang Dynasty. And then when Japan became powerful in late 19th century and early 20th century, started to become very aggressive and invaded China. And so World War II became this issue in this particular historical context. So my first question is that if we suppose there could be some reconciliation between Japan and China in these eight issues that Ambassador Togo brought up, is there going to be deeper level? Is there going to be remaining grievances and animosity remaining in the relationship between Japan and China? And it seems to me that it's part of the popular culture that China, part of the popular culture and psychology that China is overcoming now. I don't really know how to frame it, but I think it's kind of a superior complex. We used to be powerful. We used to be superior. Now we're backward in economy and et cetera, et cetera. So I think as China moves along in its path to political and economic modernization, when it's going to be probably take a long time, but it will take a more economically and culturally prosperous and confident China to overcome this complex, and that will probably be a date where true reconciliation can come forth. And then the second question relates to earlier comments of Professor Diggers. So what is this purpose of reconciliation? If it is strongly related to security issues, then are there really some imminent threats in East Asia that requires reconciliation in order to keep the stability in the region? On the other hand, suppose reconciliation can be materialized. Structurally speaking, Asia lacks the kind of incentives which brought European Union together in Europe. So I also don't see a necessary connection between reconciliation and a closer or deeper degree of Asian regional integration. So I was just wondering whether our speakers have comments on these issues. Thank you.
Okay, anybody, briefly?
I'm quite taken by the psychological dimension of this. And when I started my field research on Sino-Japanese relations, and I kept going back to China, I often heard the term "shell urban," the small Japan. And there was this feeling that China was developing and Japan was ahead, but really it was just a small Japan that you look down. And then I saw around 1999 a change, at least at the intellectual elites that I was talking to in China, that China had now arrived, its era was coming, and China could therefore be more magnanimous. And it was at that time that this new thinking was beginning to emerge that Professor Rosman was talking about. And China was reaching out. And from about 1999 to 2002, there was this real possibility. And what I found tragic was that during that time, rather than Japan responding in a positive fashion, there was still a lot of very negative view of China that was the holdover of the post-Tiananmen period. And so there wasn't this positive feedback, and instead there were the visits to Yasukuni, which then made it very difficult for this more new thinking, magnanimous attitude. Now, on the broader implications, you know, I think one part of the purpose of this reconciliation, of course, is for Japan to re-enter Asia. But for me, it's both the opportunity costs and the exacerbation of the challenges, you know, the view that Professor Rosman has. I mean, we are now in a period of a dramatic power transition. And if you look back in history, human beings have not been very good at dealing with power transitions in a way that avoided war. So it's a hard enough exercise as it is. And so you don't want the history issue then to exacerbate the problem with misperceptions, demonization, and things that go against the feeling of national honor and pride of countries. And that's why, you know, I feel that it's really important to engage this history issue.
I think your observation that in order for China to become really, harmonize, reconcile with Japan, there's need for China to to overcome its superiority inferiority complex, or for China to get real confidence. I think there's real element of truth in what you mentioned, and I think China is in a deep transition, and ultimately confidence gives this magnanimity, which will become the basis of reconciliation. But probably the same thing can be said about Japan. I think Gill's analysis about the complexity of the issues indicate that there is certain growing lack of confidence in Japan related to its geopolitical position, its relation to China, and the way post-war Japan for 6 years have accumulated. So what I'm sort of actually hoping for, that as a person who was born in 1945 and who went through this process of post-war reconstruction, to say once again that, well, yeah, there are things which we need to honor and preserve from pre-war period, but there are things which we, Japan, have created in the whole post-war period about which we can be proud and confident. This may give a little more room for sort of magnanimity on our part, which I hope will become further basis for my long-term strategic objective of re-entering Asia in a real way. But naturally, it will take time. I'm not optimistic that things can be achieved immediately. But I think direction is paramountly important. Where are we going, heading for?
I'm sorry, but
I'll briefly add my remarks. There are people in Japan, Professor Tanaka there, I think, is one, who are studying middle-class values and how they are spreading in Asia, and the possibility that they'll help bring people towards convergence, thinking more alike, and also increasing the potential for creating a common community in the region. And I'm hopeful about that. I think that's a helpful and positive step. But I also think that symbols matter a lot, and that we're in an age where a lot of countries can be confused about the way the world is going and make the wrong decisions, and public opinion can be easily aroused. And if we look at South Korea and Japan, where we would think there is so much basis for accomplishing exactly what you said, South Koreans are pretty confident about the state of their society and their economy, and yet they in Japan have a lot of troubles too. And therefore, I think this is a message that we really have to have leadership to address these symbols. Otherwise, even the objective conditions won't be sufficient.
Well, I must say that it is very difficult for me to stand without any asking any questions. And so that I'm going to assign myself the last question. Well, last comment, it does not require a comment. But I would like to emphasize the importance of U.S.-Japanese aspects of it. The United States not merely... the United States has acted as a sort of silent observer bystanders without involving itself. And it is not really a matter of Japan and its neighbors. But I think it really comes down to that very, very important question. It's a really, really big question, is how the United States and Japan can reconcile itself, because there is a latent discordant between us. So, with that very deep thought, I would like to end this session. I think it was a very stimulating discussion. Thank you very much, Roseman and Ambassador. Thank you very much for your patience.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.